Thank you for purchasing Free Tours by Foot and Atlantis Audio Tours self-guided audio tour. I wanted to let you know how this works before you get started. The audio tour is one long audio file. You can pause between stops as you walk there, allowing you to take your time and to stop to explore something more if you'd like. I'll let you know as we move between stops. You'll also find a Google map and a PDF in your confirmation email, in case you'd like to check where you are or read along with your guide. Now let's get started with your tour, and I'll let you know when to pause to get to your next stop.
Hello and welcome to the Free Tours by Foot self-guided audio tour of New Orleans' Garden District. I'm Andrew, one of the guides with Free Tours by Foot, here to help you explore the neighborhood. Before we start, a few notes to help you prepare. Depending on your pace, the tour can take between 90 minutes and 2 hours, and the total distance is about 1.5 miles or 2.5 kilometers. I'll be providing verbal directions as you go, and you can also reference the map for alternate routes or to make sure you're on track. There will be a brief pause between stops, and you can pause to take your time getting from one place to the next. The Garden District is a mostly residential neighborhood, and it's peaceful and safe almost any time of the day, but I suggest taking the tour during the daylight or early in the evening. You'll want good lighting, both to see the neighborhood's houses and to keep safe on our rocky sidewalks. Also, one of the stops is Lafayette Cemetery No. 1. You can see inside through a gate at any time of the day, but if you'd like to go inside, make sure you arrive during open hours, which are 7 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. Monday through Friday, and 7 a.m. to 12 p.m. Saturday. The cemetery is closed on Sunday and some holidays. Because it's a residential neighborhood, you're going to find fairly few buildings you can enter. One of the early stops on the tour is The Rink, a small shopping mall with a cafe, so I recommend that as the place for stocking up on anything you need or else preparing before you arrive. Lastly, as far as getting there, the starting point for the tour is the intersection of St. Charles Avenue and Washington Avenue. It's a few miles from the French Quarter, but it's along the St. Charles Avenue streetcar, and not far from the route of the No. 11 bus that runs along Magazine Street. Either way, you want to get off at Washington Avenue. Our tour begins at the intersection of St. Charles Avenue and Washington Avenue. At this point, you're standing just inside the Garden District, and from here, you can get a sense of the enormous 19th century homes the neighborhood is famous for. If you took the streetcar from the French Quarter or the Business District, then you've just experienced the daily commute a resident of this neighborhood might have taken as far back as 1835 when a train was first installed, although back then, it would have been pulled by a mule. The cars you see today date back to 1923, and together, they're a National Historic Monument. When tracks were first laid here, the Garden District was brand new. In 1833, it turned from a plantation into a small independent city called Lafayette. The train connected Lafayette with New Orleans, or what today we call the French Quarter, as well as some other small cities further afield. I mentioned Lafayette was formerly a plantation, called the Livaudais Plantation, and that's true of almost all of New Orleans today. Usually the plantations were long, narrow strips of land running from the Mississippi River back into the swamps. Before they were drained, those swamps would have begun just a few blocks north of where you're standing now, while to the south of you was the elevated, dry, fertile river levee, the ideal place to farm and also to build. As the population of the area grew, plantation owners stood to make more money by selling their land to developers than they could make by farming it, and the land gradually transformed from rural to urban over the course of the 19th century. Today, there's almost nothing left from that plantation-era history of New Orleans, but you can see a couple of echoes from where you're standing. First, if you look either way along St. Charles Avenue, you'll see that the street goes in a slow, steady curve. That curve matches the shape of the Mississippi River, and in fact, originally, St. Charles Avenue was named Naiads Street, after the spirits of the river from Greek mythology. The curve in the street is made up of lots of small bends, and each of those bends falls about where there was once a boundary between two plantations. So from where you're standing, you can see the edges of the old Livaudais Plantation, the nearest bend in the street in either direction. The other vestige of the plantation era is more a matter of ambiance. It's the two rows of southern live oak trees lining the street on either side. Trees like these would typically have lined the drive leading to the front door of a plantation house, and you can still see that famous feature with surviving plantations like Oak Alley. The trees also give away one of the street's most important functions today. If you look up, you'll see beads hanging from the branches, evidence that you're standing along the main route for Mardi Gras parades. The beads are meant to end up in the hands of spectators, but these got thrown a little too enthusiastically. From here, proceed one block south along Washington Avenue, toward the Mississippi River and the heart of the Garden District.
Pause here until you get to your next stop.
On the left side of Washington Avenue, just before the intersection with Britannia Street, you can find a commemorative plaque that welcomes visitors to the Garden District. On it, you can see the earlier name of this piece of land, the Livaudet Plantation. Madame Livaudet, its owner, was a Creole woman, a term that can mean a lot of things, but in this case means that she was from a French family, but born in Louisiana. She received the plantation as part of a settlement when she separated from her husband, and she soon sold it to developers and moved away to Paris. You can also see again the name the area had back when it was an independent city, Lafayette, after the French Marquis de Lafayette, who fought in the American Revolutionary War. Washington Avenue, where you're standing, is similarly named for a Revolutionary War figure, George Washington, the first U.S. president. And further down in the Garden District, you can find a Jackson Avenue, named for Andrew Jackson, also regarded as a war hero at the time the neighborhood came into being. From all these names, you might be able to guess who the people were who named the streets in Lafayette. Anglo-Americans, largely born in the Northeast, traveling south into newly American Louisiana to make their fortunes. The Louisiana Purchase in 1803 had added New Orleans, then one of the biggest ports in the world, to the young United States, along with booming sugar and cotton plantations further up the Mississippi. This wasn't the first time Americans had come to New Orleans. Plenty of American frontiersmen made an annual trip down the Mississippi to sell goods here in the port. But after the Louisiana Purchase, more and wealthier Americans started to come here and measured their stays in years rather than days. Some of the new American arrivals bought plantations or started enterprises in shipping or warehousing, and others got involved in banking, building, and other industries, creating English-speaking versions of anything the French-speaking city already had. And of course, some became part of the industry that fueled all this money-making, the slave trade. The industry of slavery was an enormous driver of the wealth that built the Garden District. One of those early frontiersmen making his way down the Mississippi into New Orleans later described the experience of slave markets here as a foundational event in forming his worldview. This was a young Abraham Lincoln, who would later become president and sign the Emancipation Proclamation that ended legal slavery in the U.S. Regardless of industry, most of this commerce took place in today's business district, and you can still find early 19th century commercial buildings in that area. But after hours, many who worked there retired to residences here. Today, the Garden District is one of New Orleans' protected historic districts. It covers the wealthy core of the original city of Lafayette, where homes dating as far back as 1838 can still be found. Our next subject is the mustard brown building to your left. This building contains a small shopping center called The Rink. The building was constructed in 1884, the year New Orleans hosted the World Cotton Centennial Exposition. The whole city prepared to entertain huge crowds of visitors, and on this site, that meant building a skating rink. Most of the event took place in what's now Audubon Park, further up the St. Charles streetcar line. Because the Garden District is an almost entirely residential neighborhood, the rink is the only easily accessible commercial establishment you'll find in the course of the tour. It contains Still Perkin, a cafe where you can get a quick pastry or sandwich, or a cafe au lait or chicory coffee to carry with you. It also contains the Garden District Bookstore, which has hosted many a book signing for the neighborhood's famous novelist, Anne Rice, the author of Interview with the Vampire and many other novels about vampires and the supernatural. You can see photos in the shop window of a theatrical mock funeral staged during one of her book promotions, and inside you'll find a barrister bookcase filled with signed copies of her work for sale. In any case, this is your best chance to stop for food, coffee, water, a restroom, an ATM, or anything else you may need for the remainder of the tour. When you're ready, head from the rink to the opposite corner of this intersection, to where you can see the white painted brick wall of Lafayette Cemetery No. 1. Halfway along the wall on Washington Avenue, you'll find the cemetery gate. Take a look inside.
Pause here until you get to your next stop.
Lafayette Cemetery No. 1 was established in 1833 and named for the city where it was located. Lafayette No. 1 is a municipal cemetery, owned and operated by the city rather than by a church, and it's the third oldest cemetery still standing in New Orleans today. 27 or more nationalities are represented in its interments. A look at the names on the tombs will reveal some of the more common birthplaces. Many of these tombs belonged neither to French-speaking Creoles nor to English-speaking Americans, but to immigrants from many places. Immigrants tended to live around the northern and southern edges of Lafayette, areas too close to the swamps or to the port to be desirable for wealthier residents. Today, these areas aren't considered part of the Garden District. To the north, where you would have found an Eastern European Jewish population, is what we call Central City today, while to the south lived Irish and German immigrants in what today is called the Irish Channel. If you take a walk down the center aisle, look at the fourth tomb on the right, where the Searcy family buried three children in 2 days. Yellow fever epidemics caused many such tragedies in 19th century New Orleans, particularly among newcomers to the area, like most of the residents of Lafayette, who lacked exposure and immunity to the region's diseases. Most tombs in the cemetery, like this one, are family tombs. Many of the monuments have a single name written across the top, usually a head of household who originally built the tomb, and you'll often find his surname repeated through many of the inscriptions below. The above-ground style of burial you see practiced in this cemetery is historically the norm in New Orleans, going as far back as the late 1700s. And while this particular cemetery is sparsely used today, the traditional method of above-ground burial is still common across town and across South Louisiana. While New Orleans is famously a low-lying city with a high water table, elevation and groundwater weren't the original justifications for adopting above-ground burial. New Orleanians were buried in the earth for most of the city's first century of life, and we only switched to above-ground burial when France and Spain led the way. So it was fashion, more than practicality, that motivated the switch. At first, the inhabitants of Lafayette, mostly born outside Louisiana, brought with them a tradition of in-ground burial, but gradually switched to the local practice over a few decades. When you see 10 or 20 names written on a single tomb, it's easy to wonder where all those people are, considering the modest size of these monuments. For one thing, the tomb is bigger than it looks. Most of them go several feet into the ground. A typical family tomb has between 1 and 3 vaults behind its front plaque. Burying someone inside means removing the plaque and opening one of the vaults. These brick structures have the effect of magnifying and prolonging the Louisiana heat. And with the high temperatures inside, biodegradation speeds up, typically running its course in a year, much faster than would be the case with an in-ground burial. For a long time, cemetery rules required vaults to be left sealed for a full year after an interment. The next time the vault was opened and a new body put in, the bones of the last body would be removed and transferred down to the underground space mentioned earlier. So it's a 2-step burial process. The first step happens after the funeral, and the second step happens a year or more later, when the vault is needed for someone new. Head a little further along the center walkway until you reach the crossroads at the center of the cemetery. On the right side, you'll see the Jefferson Fire Company tomb, a huge 28-vault monument with a relief on the top depicting an 1850s fire truck. This is a society tomb, a structure built and owned not by a family, but by an organization, in this case, a fire company. All kinds of professional and social organizations built society tombs, with affordable burial being one of the benefits of membership. While some of them are large, it's not always the case. You can find a smaller 12-vault fire company tomb just across the right-hand path from this one, and a short way along the left path, you can see a 4-vault society tomb designated for use by an orphanage. If you want to keep exploring the cemetery, you can find some highlights by continuing down the center path. Turn right on the second-to-last row. A few steps down on the left, you'll find a large cast-iron tomb reading Karsten Diek on the front. The design of this tomb was the basis for the tomb belonging to the vampire Lestat in both the novel and film versions of Anne Rice's Interview with the Vampire. Anne Rice took lots of inspiration from the neighborhood where she grew up. We'll see 2 homes she lived in, renovated, and wrote about further along in the tour. And her fame and stature in New Orleans helped a local cemetery preservation nonprofit called Save Our Cemeteries to fundraise for the restoration of this tomb in 2016. Besides Interview with the Vampire, footage shot in this cemetery can be found in the film Double Jeopardy and the TV show NCIS New Orleans. Parts of American Horror Story Coven were shot in nearby Lafayette Cemetery No. 2. Fans of the TV show The Originals will recognize the gate of the cemetery, but like most of the show, scenes ostensibly set inside the cemetery were shot on sets in Atlanta. And finally, and maybe most notably, you can see a game of hide-and-seek set in this cemetery in the music video for The Right Stuff by the New Kids on the Block. When you're ready, exit the cemetery where you came in, on Washington Avenue, and walk left, back to Britannia Street. Turn right on Britannia and proceed one block, where you'll see a fence with a cornstalk design on the right.
Pause here until you get to your next stop.
This house, Colonel Short's Villa, was built by architect Henry Howard for Kentucky-born Colonel Robert Short in 1859. Local lore says that Short's wife complained of missing the cornfields in her native Iowa, and that he bought the cornstalk fence as a gift for her. An alternative explanation, suggested by previous owners, is that the wife saw that it was the most expensive fence available in the catalog and requested it on that basis. Whatever the reason, it's a rarely seen design. It has one other original location in New Orleans, in front of the Cornstalk Fence Hotel in the French Quarter. The American Civil War began just after the house was built, and the U.S. military took and occupied New Orleans early on as a strategic move to cut off Confederate supply lines. Colonel Short's villa was commandeered in September of 1862, and both Governor Nathaniel Banks and Major General Benjamin Butler lived inside. As a result of the early occupation, New Orleans, unlike many southern cities, evaded destruction from Sherman's march. Colonel Short's villa also helps make clear the reason for the Garden District's current name. As it was first laid out, each block in the Garden District was split into just four large square lots, so homeowners had room for expansive gardens. Some homes, like this one, still retain that widely spaced character, but it's less common than it once was. The American Civil War caused many of the neighborhood's residents, who depended on the slave-driven plantation economy for their income, to become less wealthy, and this sometimes resulted in them selling off former garden space. As you're moving on, take notice of the street name, Britannia. Adapted from Prytaneum, the name of the city hall in ancient democratic Athens, this street name parallels other classical imagery in the neighborhood. Again, Naiad Street was a former name of St. Charles Avenue, and Dryad Street, named for Greek tree spirits, is nearby, as well as other streets named for the Nine Muses. These street names didn't originate in Lafayette. They came from the older garden suburb next door, which today we call the Lower Garden District. At the time the name Britannia was chosen, it was meant literally. A piece of land was set aside for a building that never ended up being constructed. These colorful names were chosen by the Creoles who developed the Lower Garden District. As you can see from the name of the cross street, Americans, besides naming a few streets for war heroes, mostly just filled in the rest with the first thing that came to mind, numbers. Hence, many of the intersections in the Garden District do an excellent job of depicting the stereotypical differences between Creole and American residents. Creoles focused on nobility and gentility, Americans focused on their ledger books. Continue in the same direction along Britannia Street until the next intersection, where you'll find the Briggs Staub House on the left side.
Pause here until you get to your next stop.
This home, built in 1854, is the only true example of Gothic Revival architecture in the Garden District. The powerful residents of the area were mostly Protestant. Catholicism and all its associated architectural styles belonged to the Creoles downtown, and to the working Irish and German people who lived on the fringes of Lafayette. The structure to the left of the home is a relocated kitchen and servant quarters. The original owner, Englishman Charles Briggs, staffed his home with Irish indentured servants rather than owning slaves. While in Creole parts of town, a wealthy home's domestic workers were nearly always enslaved, the work in American homes might be done either by enslaved people or by immigrants, depending on the individual owner's whim. In either case, they would likely have lived on site, and it's still common to find these detached service structures here and throughout the historic neighborhoods of New Orleans. Continue along Britannia to the next house on the same side.
Pause here until you get to your next stop.
This house used to have a gazebo in the yard reading, "Our Mother of Perpetual Help," with a statue of the Virgin Mary inside. The building on the site began as a home and is one again today, but the gazebo highlighted an important phase in the middle. Between the 1920s and the 1990s, this site was owned by the Redemptorist Order of the Catholic Church. By the 20th century, the lines between Catholic and Protestant parts of town had blurred. The house served as a home for elderly priests, and with the closure of some of the neighborhood's Catholic churches, some Garden District residents attended Mass here, including a young Anne Rice, who went on to buy it from the Redemptorists in 1990, prompting plenty of scandalized letters to the editor. She converted it back into a home and wrote a novel called Violin, set partly inside the house, and the neighborhood Mass-goers moved a small chapel onto Jackson Avenue to attend instead. When the house changed hands in 2021, the gazebo was moved off the site, first to the grounds of the nearby Danish consulate, then to one of the Irish Channel's Catholic churches. The home was designed by architect Henry Howard in 1857. Most of his works, including this house, were in the Italianate style, like Colonel Short's villa, the house we saw first. You'll also notice gas lights on the porch that burn all day and night. Lights like these, found on many historic New Orleans buildings, uphold a tradition that dates to the earliest days of the Garden District. James Caldwell, an Englishman, moved to New Orleans in 1820, and while he made his living as a theater manager and actor, he somehow also found the time for politics, affairs, public rivalries, and a pet project to give New Orleans the country's first municipal gas lighting system. The city of Lafayette was founded just as his enterprise began, and so the neighborhood didn't have to go without light for long. Caldwell's arguable masterpiece was the St. Charles Theater, a staggering Greek Revival building in today's business district, famous for its giant gas chandelier. The theater seated 4,100, more than any theater in New Orleans today, and at a time when the population of New Orleans was only about 100,000. Today it's been replaced by a skyscraper. The theater burned down, although to Caldwell's credit, the fire didn't start with his gas chandelier, but from a small blaze in a wood shop next door. Enormous commercial ambitions like this were an essential part of the story of early American New Orleans, when the city was home to many of the nation's wealthiest people. Since so many of the commercial buildings of that time are gone, today the Garden District remains the best, if incomplete, evidence of New Orleans's era of greatest power. This house was also part of the brief but memorable tenure of Nicolas Cage in New Orleans. He owned it and the famous La Lurie mansion in the French Quarter before losing them both to bankruptcy. He still owns a huge pyramid tomb in St. Louis Cemetery No. 1. Continue along Britannia to this block's last building on the right.
Pause here until you get to your next stop.
The standout homes in the Garden District often include more than one style. Designed by William Ferret in 1859, this building combines a Greek Revival structure and Italian metalwork with a Queen Anne extension, folding together styles that came and went from local fashion across half a century. Now owned by the Women's Opera Guild, the home can be toured on Mondays from 1 to 4 p.m. Films made in the house include Elsa and Peter and the Quentin Tarantino film Django Unchained. Greek Revival architecture, like what you see in the main structure of this house, was popular in the early days of the Garden District partly because of homeowners' philosophical roots. Americans who took pride in their country's representative democracy saw their system of government as carrying on the tradition of ancient Athens and the Roman Republic. And accordingly, they built in styles that evoked those cultures. So early Lafayette would have looked sort of like a residential version of the complex of government buildings in Washington, D.C. Continue down Britannia for another block, cross First Street, and find the first house on the right.
Pause here until you get to your next stop.
This home, called Toby's Corner, is the Garden District's oldest still-standing residence, built in 1838. Compared to other similarly large houses in the neighborhood, you can see this one is fairly simple, with basic Doric columns rather than the more elaborate Ionic or Corinthian varieties, and little decoration beyond the simple dentil pattern along the edges of the roof. These Greek Revival design touches hint that it was built for an American owner, but the basic form of the house looks more like 18th century Creole residences. This house type was well adapted to the region, with a ground floor basement for flooding and ventilation, high ceilings, and plenty of windows to take advantage of breezes. Buildings like this are rare today, mostly plantation houses and a couple of examples in the French Quarter, the Creole part of the city having rebuilt from fires in a Spanish colonial style. Take a look through the front gate, located just a short way down Britannia Street. In front of the house, you can see a sugar kettle being used as a fountain. Sugar kettles were tools in the process of sugar granulation. Sugarcane was boiled in successively smaller containers to render it into the crystallized form that could be sold. While cotton is often the first crop popularly associated with Louisiana, sugarcane is much more common in the southern part of the state, which is too wet for cotton cultivation. While sugarcane had long been the primary crop of the Caribbean, South Louisiana, with its dry spells and occasional winter freezes, had never seen successful sugar cultivation until 1795, when a first successful crop was harvested on the plantation of Étienne de Boré, using new planting and irrigation strategies. After that, plantations in the area converted to sugarcane en masse, and today Louisiana remains the northernmost sugarcane-producing region in the world. The Louisiana sugar industry claims that the state annually produces enough granulated sugar to halfway fill the Superdome. And you can still find the place where it all started. The De Boré Plantation falls within today's Audubon Park. Now, look across Britannia Street and you'll see a much more elaborate structure, the Bradish Johnson House. Architect James Ferret designed this mansion in the French Second Empire style for sugar baron Bradish Johnson in 1872. This is a style that became popular during the Reconstruction era that followed the American Civil War. You can find more examples if you take the St. Charles streetcar going further uptown, away from the quarter. While many inhabitants of the Garden District sided with the Confederacy, the southern states that seceded from the U.S. leading to the Civil War, Bradish Johnson was one of the residents who sided with the United States. A trip out of town can bring you to one of the plantations he owned, Whitney Plantation, which today offers tours focused on what is known of the lives and experiences of enslaved people. Today, this property belongs to the private Louise McGee School for Girls, which occupies the entire block. They celebrated their centennial in 2012. From here, turn back along Britannia to the intersection with First Street, then turn left. Continue along First Street until you find a tan house on the right.
Pause here until you get to your next stop.
This was the home of former New Orleans Saints quarterback Archie Manning, as well as the childhood home of his sons Peyton, Eli, and Cooper Manning. The family were full-time residents for decades and a common sight in the neighborhood. Lots of footage from a 2013 documentary about the family, titled The Book of Manning, was shot at the home. Archie and his sons co-run a local summer high school football training program, and Archie also co-owns a restaurant and sports bar called Manning's in the business district. From here, you've got a couple of options. You're not far from the largest house in the neighborhood, the Buckner Mansion. And besides being impressive to see, the house is familiar to some visitors for its role in the show American Horror Story: Coven. It's a few blocks walk, but it's worth seeing. So if you're excited for that, continue along First Street. Make a left at Coliseum Street and continue two blocks to Jackson Avenue. Otherwise, if you'd like to save time, just make your way along First Street to the intersection with Camp Street and skip ahead to the story about the Payne Strawn House.
Pause here until you get to your next stop.
The massive house at Coliseum and Jackson, built in 1856, is the Buckner Mansion, the largest home in the neighborhood. As you approach on Coliseum Street, you're seeing the back of the house, including a long three-story extension. This is the home's slave quarters. As you come around to the front of the house on Jackson Avenue, you'll get the full sense of its size, over 20,000 square feet. Henry Buckner, its namesake, was the cotton magnate who commissioned the house, and his family continued to live there until 1923, when it became a business school. You can still see a mosaic stating its educational mission by the front gate. Now it's again a single-family home, but it got to play the part of a school in American Horror Story: Coven. The show used the exterior of the building, but for interior scenes, a full-scale home was built on a soundstage, just a short distance away in the Irish Channel. Indirectly, that series presents yet another of the neighborhood's ties with novelist Anne Rice, who debuted the idea of witches living in the Garden District with her novel The Witching Hour in 1990. Before you leave, notice again the name of the street that got you here, Coliseum Street. Remember how Britannia Street was named for something that never got built? The same is true of Coliseum. If you proceeded further down this street into the Lower Garden District, you'd find a place called Coliseum Square Park, a beautiful green space originally planned as the site for the neighborhood's very own Coliseum, meant to be used for public festivities and assemblies. A fountain now stands where it was supposed to be. From here, head south along Jackson Avenue, then take the second right onto Camp Street. Proceed two blocks to the intersection with First Street and look for the first house on your left, fronting onto First.
Pause here until you get to your next stop.
This is the Payne Strawn House. Jefferson Davis, the first and only president of the short-lived Confederate States of America, died here in December 1889. At the time when Southern states began to secede and form the Confederate States of America, Davis was a U.S. senator for Mississippi, who had also served as Secretary of War and as a U.S. Army colonel. He was chosen as the Confederate president by representatives at a constitutional convention. At the end of the war, in May of 1865, he was captured and imprisoned. But 2 years later, a blanket amnesty was issued for all those charged with treason in connection with the war, Davis included. Afterward, he wrote a history of the Confederacy and gave lectures in which he reinterpreted the original reasons for the war away from slavery and toward a noble, if doomed, defense of the Southern way of life. This vision of the lost cause became extremely popular in the Reconstruction era South, and it became the underpinning for popular views of the Civil War from then on, including the famous Gone with the Wind. Jefferson was traveling to New Orleans as part of his long speaking tour when he became ill, and he was brought here to the home of Judge Charles Fenner, where he spent his final hours. A block to the left along First, you can see Magazine Street, the boundary between the Garden District and the more working-class Irish Channel neighborhood. Magazine itself has been one of New Orleans's foremost commercial corridors since the middle of the 19th century. This street runs 6 miles from the edge of the French Quarter through the length of uptown New Orleans, alternating between commercial and residential pockets. The commercial sections grew up around 4 neighborhood markets, similar to the French Market in the French Quarter, that provided for the daily needs of people within walking distance. Today, restaurants, boutiques, art galleries, and antique stores have more or less replaced the necessities that used to line the street, but it still has plenty of 19th century buildings and a 19th century pedestrian friendliness. If you're looking for a meal after the tour, you can find lots of options in the nearest of Magazine Street's commercial pockets, one of which borders the Garden District between Washington Avenue and Louisiana Avenue, and another of which touches the corner of the neighborhood at Jackson Avenue near the Buckner Mansion. And a city bus runs along Magazine Street that can help you explore the other portions. From here, turn north onto First Street, going away from Magazine Street, and proceed until you reach the intersection with Chestnut Street.
Pause here until you get to your next stop.
On either side of First Street stand the former homes of writers turned restorers. On the left, at 1236 First Street, lived Julia Reed, a writer for Vogue, Garden and Gun, and other publications besides. She started a restoration of this then-neglected house shortly before Hurricane Katrina, and wrote a memoir about the experience called The House on First Street. On the right, at 1239 First Street, is the Brevard Rice House, restored by Anne Rice when she returned as a newly successful novelist to her home city in 1972. Like Julia Reed, she restored the home and wrote about the process. But rather than writing a memoir, Anne Rice fictionalized the experience, making the house the ancestral home for a family of witches. The resulting novel, The Witching Hour, and its 2 sequels pair Rice's personal knowledge of home restoration and a Garden District upbringing with the supernatural horror she's best known for. She sold the home in 2003 after the death of her husband, Stan Rice. Originally designed in 1857 as a Greek Revival home, the house shows some of Rice's modern additions, like the Italian at bay on its southern side and a skylight to the north. Notice the Rose Gate fence, believed to be one of the first chain-link fence designs in the world. Viewers today, especially fans of Anne Rice's work, often see skulls rather than rosebuds. When Anne Rice bought the house in 1972, she got it from another wordsmith, a judge named John Minor Wisdom, who sat on the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals and is the namesake for the building where that court meets today in New Orleans' business district. Judge Wisdom wrote decisions furthering school desegregation and voting rights in the Deep South. Continue along First Street, stopping at the last house on the right before the intersection with Coliseum Street.
Pause here until you get to your next stop.
This 1860 house is classic Italianate design, the style that grew most popular in the Garden District in the late 1850s. Like many New Orleans homes, this one is narrow along the street, but extends far back on the lot. I mentioned earlier how the default division of lots on a block created four large squares, but if those failed to sell, they were often split lengthwise, sometimes more than once, to form multiple lots, leaving owners with no choice but to build long, rectangular homes. After enough divisions, this would lead to one of the classic working-class house styles in New Orleans, the shotgun house, which consists of a row of five or six rooms connected one to the next with no hallway. Shotgun houses are rare in the Garden District, but common in the Irish Channel and Central City. From here, turn left onto Coliseum Street and proceed one block to the last house on the right.
Pause here until you get to your next stop.
This home, called the Joseph Merrick Jones House, currently belongs to the actor John Goodman, known locally for his role on the post-Katrina HBO drama Tremé by David Simon, creator of The Wire. Thanks to his depiction of a staunch defender of New Orleans culture in Tremé and his real-life advocacy, many New Orleanians have given him the rare honor of being seen as a native. John Goodman bought the home in 2005, shortly before Hurricane Katrina, from its previous owner, Trent Reznor, the singer of Nine Inch Nails. Notice the sky blue color of the ceiling on the front porch. This color is typical for outdoor ceilings throughout the Gulf South. Many residents believe it keeps winged insects from nesting there or wards off evil spirits. Originally, it was a paint mixed with lye that would have genuinely kept nesting animals away, but today the color is kept as a matter of tradition rather than practicality. The name of the color, haint blue, comes from the Appalachian word haint, a variation on haunt, meaning a ghost. Continue along Coliseum Street and pause at the next block's last house on the left.
Pause here until you get to your next stop.
As you get near the house, take a look in the backyard. Here you'll see the most extensive set of 19th century outbuildings remaining in the neighborhood. The one furthest from the street is a stable, carriage house, and garçonnière. A garçonnière being a small separate residence where the young men of wealthy families moved when they entered their teens. The next building nearer to the street is a slave quarters and kitchen. A cistern for water storage still exists but isn't visible from the street. The garage is a modern cinder block structure disguised to look better suited to the period. This home was built in 1853 for Michel Mousson, one of the few Creoles living in the Garden District before the Civil War. He was the uncle of French artist Edgar Degas. Degas briefly stayed with relatives in another home on Esplanade Avenue during a visit to New Orleans. You can tour that home, now called the Degas House. While Creoles and Anglo-Americans differed on plenty of fronts, they sometimes found common ground around the ways they made money. Mousson was a cotton broker, and Creoles in his position often formed business ties with Americans and also found common cause with their neighbors as supporters of the Confederacy. When you reach the corner, look at the house on the opposite side of Coliseum Street.
Pause here until you get to your next stop.
Construction on this Italianate home, called the Robinson House, began in 1859 and didn't end until 1865. It was designed by architect Henry Howard for tobacco merchant Walter Robinson. The property is one of the larger ones in the Garden District at 12,000 square feet. The flat roof once served to gather rainwater for the home's early version of an indoor plumbing system. It went up for sale in 2010 at an unusually high listing price of $12.5 million, but ultimately only sold for about half that in 2017. Continue along Coliseum until you reach the next block's last building on the right.
Pause here until you get to your next stop.
This Swiss-Germanic chalet, built in 1867, is one of only three homes of this style in the entirety of New Orleans. The outer appearance of stonework is an illusion, often created in this area where stone is hard to come by, made by plastering a brick building and enhancing the plaster facade with lines that suggest the joints between stones. It was designed by architect William Ferret for James Eustis, a one-time U.S. senator. Today, it belongs to Sandra Bullock. She bought it in 2009, shortly before her adopted son Louis was born in New Orleans. Locals also appreciate her contributions to restoring Warren Easton High School, a large public school that was damaged in Hurricane Katrina. Between her and the architecture, this is one of the more looked-at homes in the neighborhood, but she's rarely here. She does have a history of lending it out to other celebrities, though, so you never know who might step out through the gate. Continue along Coliseum, crossing the street to view the next house on the same side.
Pause here until you get to your next stop.
This house was one of the main shooting locations for the film The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, and also one the film had to fight hardest to secure. The director chose the house as the ideal setting for the retirement home where the title character lives for many years, but the owner, who at the time was evacuated to Houston thanks to Hurricane Katrina, refused the request, as she had with many requests from film companies in the past. It took the director personally convincing her that the film would portray New Orleans in a positive, hopeful light, much needed after Hurricane Katrina, to change her mind. The film shows the home inside and out. It sold shortly after the production for about $1.5 million. The design of the house shows the broad array of visual styles the Americans living in the neighborhood drew from. Ionic columns on the ground floor, Queen Anne reliefs on the second floor, and Gothic arches in Greek Revival dormers on a roof of part shingle, part Spanish tile. Notice on the opposite side of the street a row of five mostly identical houses. These were built shortly before the Civil War as a real estate speculation by William Ferret, an architect who was the son of a New Orleans mayor. Ferret lost his investment when the war began, but went on to become one of the city's best-known architects in the coming decades. His projects included Sandra Bullock's house on the previous block. From here, continue along Coliseum Street to the end of the block. You'll see to your left a couple of the small shotgun houses mentioned earlier, long, narrow, working-class homes commonly seen across New Orleans. You'll also see ahead of you the wall of Lafayette Cemetery No. 1. And on the right, you'll see a turquoise and white building, the home of Commander's Palace Restaurant.
Pause here until you get to your next stop.
Commander's Palace is one of New Orleans' most famous Creole restaurants. Creole cuisine is New Orleans' most traditional fare. In this case, it's the local innovation on French cuisine, sharing many of the same names for dishes and essential sauces, but adapting to locally available ingredients. It also shows influence from the Spanish and West African inhabitants of the region. Jambalaya, for example, being derived from Spanish paella and West African benichin. Commander's was originally opened not by Creoles, but by a father-son team of Sicilian immigrants, Peter and Emile Commander, who opened a saloon under the name in 1893. It transitioned to being a restaurant during its first few years and went through the hands of various owners. Since 1974, it's been owned by the Brennans, the famous and notably Irish-descended family of local Creole restaurateurs, who gave the building its current distinctive paint job. Besides receiving many awards, Commander's has helped launch the careers of some great chefs, including Imre Lagasse, who now has several of his own restaurants throughout the city, and Paul Prudhomme, who played a key role in introducing the world outside Louisiana to Cajun food through books and television shows. Commander's is also where the local tradition of jazz brunch originated, and they still host it every weekend. Otherwise, the restaurant's signature is weekday martini lunches, 25 cents for a martini with a main dish. Reservations are required, and there is a dress code. If after all this exploring you're eager for a meal but Commander's isn't the thing, you can find plenty of restaurants on nearby Magazine Street. Just head south on Washington for three blocks and make a right on Magazine and you'll find lots of choices. Otherwise, from here, you're just a block south of the Rink, the mall and cafe from near the start of the tour, and one more block in the same direction is St. Charles Avenue, where the tour began, and where you can catch the streetcar for further sightseeing if you'd like. And please pay a visit to www.freetoursbyfoot.com to check out some of our other offerings, including guided tours, self-guided tours, YouTube videos, and articles. We hope to see you again soon.